ritual and ethnicity in the ancient world, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen now for scholars from the University of Exeter and Rice University. Richard Seifert is here to talk about ritual in ancient Greek culture. Before that, Michael Moss will discuss ethnicity in the world of the ancient Romans.
Hunorum gens monumentis veteribus leveter nota, ultra paludes maioticas glacialem oceanum acolens, omnem modem feritatis excedit. That was Ammianus Marcellinus talking about the Huns.
Historian Michael Moss, he'll be here in just a moment to talk about ethnicity and cultural identity in the world of the ancient Romans. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. From debates about civil rights to the grim realities of ethnic cleansing, journalists and scholars alike have lately focused on the concept of ethnicity as a means to understand how differing cultures interact. One scholar who's doing so is Michael Moss, a professor of history at Rice University. He says that the ancient Romans are noteworthy because for hundreds of years they successfully managed an enormous empire of widely differing ethnic and cultural dimensions. The Romans also intrigue us because we think of them as an earlier version of ourselves, although such thinking does have its limits. I asked Michael Moss to describe the encounter between the Romans of late antiquity and the invading Germanic tribes known as the Huns. Reading in translation from one of his ancient sources, here's Michael Moss.
The people of the Huns, who are little known from ancient records, dwell beyond the Maeotic Sea, near the ice-bound ocean to the north, and they exceed every degree of savagery. Since there the cheeks of children are deeply furrowed with the steel from their very birth, in order that the growth of hair, when it appears at the proper time, may be checked by the wrinkled scars, they grow old without beards and without any beauty, like eunuchs. They all have compact, strong limbs and thick necks, and are so monstrously ugly and misshapen that one might take them for two-legged beasts or for the stumps rough-hewn into images that are used in putting sides to bridges.
You know, this could be the kind of thing that what Columbus and his people wrote back to the old world about what they found in the new. This could be about people from the eastern part of the United States writing about the territories of the unexplored American West. This could be Captain Cook writing home. It's intriguing, but it's unfortunate, isn't it?
It's really a shame that people's first experience of one another has to be so negative. Mm. On the other hand, to be fair, the Huns, by all accounts, were extremely aggressive, vicious, hard-fighting people.
What do you mean, Michael, by a term like ethnographic writing? What is that? How does that resonate?
Ethnographic writing is simply a fancy way of saying writing about or recording the customs and habits and ways of life of other peoples. It's the kind of thing that anthropologists do today when they go into a foreign culture and try to somehow get some analytical handle on it.
Okay, so who is doing this ethnographic writing that you're looking at?
Right. In Roman antiquity, there weren't any anthropologists. There were just educated people who, for one reason or another, wrote down their observations about the people with whom they came into contact. Mm-hmm. These could be historians or lawyers or soldiers or priests or any number of social roles.
Well, Michael, let me ask you to pause on a couple of specific examples. I want you to help me with
sure.
the pronunciation here. We've got Ammianus Marcellinus and Salvian of Marseille. How exotic. Tell me about one of these people.
Well, Ammianus Marcellinus is a very interesting figure. He was a soldier who lived in the last part of the 4th century AD, who became a historian. And he wrote a long history of the Roman Empire, trying to explain why it was in such terrible condition.
Gibbons before Gibbons, huh?
In a way, yeah. He really tried to explore the causes of Roman decline. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I'm particularly interested in him with this new project is that he gives us what's effectively a 1492 scenario.
Yeah, this is the guy who describes the encounter with the so-called Huns.
That's right.
Am I being politically overly correct when I say the so-called Huns?
No, they the Romans called them the Huns.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're exactly sure what they called themselves, but Huns is good enough.
Well, tell me about this encounter.
Right. The Huns were like space invaders. Hmm. They showed up out of the blue in the second half of the 4th century A.D., and began to terrify everyone. One of their leaders of another generation, Attila the Hun, is well known to us still as the Scourge of God. So their reputation was deservedly quite fierce.
All right, now the reputation, let's look back through the
sure.
Romans' eyes. Were the Huns bad guys, bad people, because they were different, or because they were intrinsically evil? How do we figure out that kind of interplay?
I think the Romans thought that they were evil because they were so different.
Fair enough.
Unlike the Romans, who were urban agriculturalists and the elite lived in cities, the Huns were pastoral nomads from Central Asia. Uh-huh. And they didn't know much about cities, and they didn't have any respect for the institutions and beliefs that the Romans based their culture on.
Is this the beginning of what we call nationalism? That is to say, that sort of walling yourself in and, me against you, us against them mentality?
I don't think it's the beginning of what we call nationalism, but it certainly is an expression of Roman sense of kind of collective identity in the face of something so very, very different. The Romans had known about nomads for a long time, but they'd never seen the Huns before. So when they showed up and threw the whole world into confusion because of their ferocity, the Romans had to figure out how to describe them, how to write about them, what to think of them.
And here is your man, Ammianus, coming.
That's right.
He'd
never seen them, as far as we know, but he wrote about them in very detailed terms. What makes this such an interesting passage for me is that virtually every element of description that he includes is taken from an even earlier author who had certainly never heard of the Huns.
Well, what he's doing here is appropriating another vocabulary.
That's right.
And applying it.
He's appropriated a very, very old vocabulary and applied it to this new situation.
Michael, let me change the subject a little bit here. Tell me about your man Salvian of Marseille. Not the subject, but the geography.
Sure. Salvian was a priest who I imagine was very, very, very unpopular with his parishioners because he didn't tell them what they wanted to hear.
About what? You mean national, ethnic differences, things like that?
Yes. In a word, the part of France where he lived was no longer ruled by the Romans. In fact, they'd been replaced by Germanic invaders who were establishing a kingdom of their own. Mm-hmm. And Salvian, who was raised as a Roman and trained as a priest, was forced to ask, like all of his contemporaries, I imagine, why had God abandoned them?
This sounds like the latter-day Puritans. The external signs point to God's disapproval.
That's it, exactly. He said, and I can't imagine they wanted to hear it, that the Romans deserved their punishment because the barbarians were better.
All right, now, better in this sense meant different and, what, superior somehow or other?
Well, this is what makes it very interesting for me. He said that the Romans were acting incorrectly, and that the barbarians were acting in a more Christian fashion, even though they were heretical Christians.
One-upsmanship here.
In a way, that's right. So what had been the traditional enemy was now seen as being superior. What I see in this, without reading too much into it, is the first glimpses of a kind of medieval mentality in which the distinction between Roman and barbarian, between imperial subject and foreigner, was no longer the basic pole of identification, but what kind of Christian you were. Uh-huh. I think one of the similarities between the modern period and the late Roman world is the fact that they're both post-imperial. In late antiquity, the Roman Empire, at least in the West, was falling apart. It was a multicultural empire.
There's a word much on our minds today.
Absolutely. Huh? We have to remember the enormous scope of this state that reached from Scotland to Mesopotamia, from Morocco to Armenia. Mm-hmm. It was an enormous territory with hundreds of different cultures and languages and peoples in it. So what happened when the old imperial grip of the Roman state slipped away? Uh-huh. This is quite similar to circumstances today. The great colonial empires of the 19th century have, it's good to say, largely disappeared around the world. The British, the French, the German, the Dutch don't exist anymore. The greatest surviving multinational empire of the 20th century has collapsed within the last few years,
right.
The Soviet Union. And even we in America have begun to question the rights and obligations and responsibilities of international interference on a wide scale. Yeah.
So the point here is that we've got to get used to the fact that there's always going to be something different out there. There's always going to be some sort of an opposing force, contrary force to what we think is right, and that eventually may come along and displace us. Is that it?
Well, that's it. But I think we also have to think about this kind of opposition that you've just outlined uh-huh. as being something that we construct.
Uh-huh.
These notions that we today want to see as absolutes, identity, nationality, ethnicity, uh-huh. are in fact constructs. And in Roman antiquity, I suppose in any period of antiquity, we can see how they were constructed. We really see people at work building identities mm-hmm. and in ways that are not the same as ours.
Michael Moss, we're talking about your project on the limits of ethnography. Here's an unlikely leap for you. Tell me why Star Trek has anything to do with the kind of stuff that you're studying here as a bona fide historian.
Well, I enjoy Star Trek a lot, and enjoy it, I think, because it explores some of these questions about the confrontations of peoples that haven't met each other before. Mm-hmm. How do people, what are the intellectual and the spiritual resources that people can bring to bear in this kind of first contact situation?
You give this TV show pretty high marks on that score?
Well, sometimes it's sillier than other times, but I enjoy watching it, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because why? It's instructive, it just gets us thinking about the issue, even if it doesn't supply particular answers?
That's right. In a kind of easygoing way, it sometimes prompts a kind of reflection on these things.
Uh-huh. Well, Michael, I want to thank you for these thoughtful reflections on your scholarship. You are working here on a project called The Limits of Ethnography. You live part of your life back there in the ancient Roman world. In the modern world, you're a professor of history at Rice University. It's been a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center. Michael, thanks, and good luck in your work.
Well, thank you very much, Wayne. It's been a pleasure.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Ritual and the Ancient Greeks. Join me now for a conversation with Richard Seaford, a scholar of classics at the University of Exeter.
The role of ritual in the mediation of social relations differs in different kinds of society. In advanced capitalism, for example, it may retain an important social role, but in a relatively fragmented and marginalized way. Certain forms of ritual may be especially important when the state does not exist or is weak, and ritual may play a substantial part in the creation of the state, in the development of the collective emotions and institutions required for the state to prevail over the autonomy of individuals and groups within it.
Classicist Richard Seaford of the University of Exeter. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project about ritual in the world of the ancient Greeks. Seaford notes that ritual is one of the important means by which we understand who we are and how we live our lives, embracing as it does ideas and practices from religion and sports to politics and the family. I asked Richard Seifert to begin his discussion by reflecting on the question of human nature. To what degree is it constant or changeable over the centuries that separate us from the Greeks of antiquity?
I don't think human nature is a constant. I think human nature is created historically. We probably have more in common with the Greeks than we do with a contemporary society which hasn't yet reached the stage where it has writing and money and so on. What's interesting about the Greeks is that they are the first people who have these important institutions which define our lives: writing, money, the state. So they act as a bridge between the kind of society that exists before those institutions and ourselves.
Is there a kind of an irony inherent in that, Richard, in the sense that here we think of the Greeks, we associate with them the practice of ritual, and yet because they represent the beginning of our modern institutions, they are the society in which these rituals started to break down?
Yes, I think that's very interesting. And the area in which the Greeks become conscious of the problematic nature of ritual, that ritual might be ambiguous, not just a force for the good, is tragedy. Tragedy is largely about the contradiction between the powerful family, the kinship group, on the one hand, and the state, this new form of social organization, on the other hand. And both those social units, the family and the state, have their rituals. So tragedy typically shows you how a family destroys itself, and in the course of doing so, perverts its rituals, like funerary ritual. And the tragedy, more often than not, ends in the foundation of a ritual by and for the state as a whole. And that's the positive conclusion of tragedy.
What about gift exchange and money, Richard Seifert? In the modern world, money is a kind of medium of exchange for us, that it, in a way that it wasn't in the ancient world. We're on the right track there?
Yes. Most of our relations, as I've said, are mediated through money and through the law, so that if we can travel 1,000 miles, and so long as we've got some money to pay for the motel, we'll be all right. Of course, ancient Greek society isn't like that. You're among strangers with whom the mediating element of money just doesn't exist. You therefore need agreed codes of behavior. Relations may be mediated through an agreed code of behavior about the giving and exchange of gifts. You go with your gifts, as I imagine the first settlers to America did.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have ritual. And our shaking hands is a vestige of this sort of thing. It has no practical effect. We just shake hands when we meet people. Well, in societies where you don't have money and law as mediating means, then you're much more likely to have quite elaborate rituals. And you can see this in Homer, for example, when strangers meet each other.
Uh-huh.
Then there's a number of steps that they go through. So ritual then is very important in the world before money, the world before the state.
Would you say that ritual plays a different function in our society when we speak of politics than it did compared with the ancient Greeks?
Well, we tend to have a negative view of ritual in politics. We would regard ritual as manipulative.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, here comes another political convention, that kind of thing.
That's right. And in Protestant cultures, or cultures influenced by Protestantism, ritual generally has a negative connotation as being concerned merely with form rather than substance. Whereas in ancient Greek society, a ritual isn't suspect in that particular way. It may indeed have been used to manipulate, but that's not how people envisage it. Ritual is for them, precisely because they don't have a law and citizenship to the extent that we do, ritual for them is an absolute imperative for the creation of a community. What the ritual does is to impress on each individual within the group an image of the group as a whole, a totality in which each individual is submerged. That's very useful in any society because it creates cohesion and strength within the group. Only those groups which have that image of themselves are likely to survive. Now, in modern society, our relations with others tend to be mediated through money and through the law. These are both single criteria which unite us all. Ancient Greek society wasn't like that, wasn't like that to the same extent. Written law and money are relatively recent inventions, and therefore ritual becomes, in a society like that, very important for creating, mediating relations between people, both within the group mm-hmm. and indeed between outsiders.
This would go to the claim, for instance, that the notion of the individual is relatively modern, set against what the way you are defining the notion of the group.
Well, yes. But of course, there are, even in ancient Greek society, individual rituals. Individuals mm-hmm. can perform rituals, but what they're doing when they perform rituals, for example, a girl making a sacrifice to Artemis before marriage, is inserting herself into a traditional and collective pattern.
Now, what did the Greeks do with their rituals? What did they represent? I mean, we can speak of major transitions in one's life, marriage, divorce, the death of a loved one, coming of age, that kind of thing. How did the Greeks think of those categories?
Well, the Greeks mark these transitions far more emphatically than we do. Huh. We're familiar with the idea of ritual marking transitions. But for example, modern psychologists say, well, one of the problems about growing up in Western society is that there is no clear marker between being a child and being an adult. And this creates all sorts of psychological problems. You don't know who you are. Hmm. And in ancient Greek society, as in many other societies of that kind, you know perfectly well when you're a child and when you're an adult, because you have a highly emotional ritual to mark that transition. I mean, that's clearly something that we can learn from the ancient Greeks.
Again, we in the modern world have our therapies. This form of ritual served that function in the ancient world. We didn't have shrinks back then, but we had something that represented what shrinks do for us today.
That's right. And one thing that ritual does for the ancient Greeks is indeed, and they say this themselves, the control of mental illness. If you're mentally ill in ancient Greece, you don't go to a shrink. They don't have shrinks. You're initiated into an uh-huh. ecstatic cult in which you work through your neurosis.
What about the family, Richard Seaford? Are there rituals that would have been commonplace among the ancient Greeks that would surprise us in the modern world when we speak of ritual and its relationship to families?
Well, I think the most surprising ritual would be the ritual of animal sacrifice, which is really basic to all sorts of Greek activities, and is something that I think actually still goes on in the United States, but on the whole, it's not part of our lives. Various sects, I think, mm-hmm. still perform.
Well, it is before the courts. There are questions before the courts now about this very thing.
That's right. Well, I mean, one reason why we no longer perform animal sacrifice is that the production of meat has become separated from the consumption of meat. Greeks, on the other hand, brought up their animals almost as part of the family. If you're going to kill somebody, an animal, which is as if part of the family, then that's a highly emotional thing to do. Anxiety surrounds it. And it's in those situations that you need a traditional ritual form in which you imagine the god is demanding the animal, and that's how sacrifice operates.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have mentioned that the god for the ancient Greeks becomes present in the ritual itself. Give me a sense, a concrete sense of that notion of representation. Are we talking about gods that look like people, gods that that look like animals? What was in the imagination of these ancient people?
Well, on the whole, Greek religion is anthropomorphic. That is to say, the gods look like people, particularly powerful and beautiful people. Occasionally, we find gods in the form of an animal. Dionysus, for example, may take the form of a bull mm-hmm. or a goat. And very few Greeks would claim that they had actually seen a god, but one possible context for imagining that you have seen a god is indeed ecstatic religion, the women on the mountainside in their ecstatic dances, may imagine that the god is in some sense present among them. They may even have claimed to have seen the god, but we don't have eyewitness reports of this.
Well, Richard Seifert, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. Let me tell our listeners about you. You're a reader in Greek literature at the University of Exeter. You have a new book coming out, 1994, Oxford University Press, Reciprocity and Ritual. It's got a wonderful subtitle, Homer and Tragedy in the Developing City-State. Richard Seifert, thank you for participating on Soundings. I wish you well in your work.
It's been a pleasure.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guests were Michael Moss of Rice University and Richard Seifert of the University of Exeter. Michael Moss is working on a book about ethnicity in ancient Rome. Richard Seifert is writing a book about ritual and the ancient Greeks. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 663. That's program number 663, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Next week, part two of Soundings on Ancient Cultures. John Darmes of the University of Michigan will be here to talk about drinking in ancient Rome. John Maxwell O'Brien of Queen's College will also be on hand to discuss his new biography, Alexander the Great, The Invisible Enemy, an account of drinking and alcohol in Alexander's life. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thank you for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Ritual and Ethnicity in the Ancient World, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for conversations featuring scholars from the University of Exeter and Rice University. Richard Seifert will be here to talk about ritual and social order in the world of the ancient Greeks. Michael Moss will also be on hand to talk about the concept of ethnicity in ancient Rome. Ritual and Ethnicity in the Ancient World. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.